I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question.
I do not support a strike on Iraq. I do not support war anywhere.
If Bush stood up tomorrow and said Saddam has a plan to smother the world in chocolate pudding, this would be reported on and this would be debated.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Wednesday, January 15th, 2003, the birthday of peacemaker, humanitarian, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Monday marked the heaviest day of U.S.-led bombing of Iraq in at least a year. The Washington Post reports that the U.S. and Britain are increasing the frequency and intensity of such attacks and that they are continuing to add to the more than 200,000 troops that are already stationed in the region. American and British warplanes have bombed over 80 targets in Iraq's southern so-called no-fly zone over the past 5 months. And while peace activists and UN diplomats look to ways to avert an all-out war, David Eisenberg of the British American Security Information Council says the U.S. war plans are nothing new.
Well, it's an open secret that pilots who have been doing overflights in the no-fly zones, both the northern and the southern no-fly zones, have long done so with an eye toward participating in future military action against Iraq to the extent that they've increased the frequency. Recently, it's probably with an effort to testing out the Iraqi air defense systems, some of which have supposedly been bolstered despite best efforts by the embargo by dint of import of military equipment from Central and Eastern European states. So to the extent that they're doing that, they're both testing it out and obviously trying to take out those systems, not only the radars, but their command and control centers, the fiber optic links, which allow some redundancy between the sites.
Do you think that the war is informally underway in Iraq? I mean, we're seeing reports of an acceleration of the actual bombing there. We know that upwards of 150,000 troops are being amassed in the region at this time. Has the war actually started and we just haven't been told?
Well, to be truthful, I've long thought that the way the situation is described puts forth a sort of false paradigm. People talk about whether or not the United States will be going to war, and that assumes that war has not been happening. Of course, I would say that the war has been on for a number of years now. I mean, any time that State X overflies the territory of State B and drops bombs on it with some frequency and regularity, no matter what you call it, you know, in a de facto sense, is in a state of war. Now, you can say it's in support of the UN Security Council Resolution 687 or enforcing the embargo or, you know, making the sanctions more punitive, but the fact is, you know, it's war by no matter whatever name you call it. So, yes, of course, we're at war. The decision now and the debate is about whether you take it to the next or highest level, i.e. a ground campaign culminating in the actual overthrow and deposition of Saddam Hussein and the subsequent installation of a new regime and the post-war occupation that occurs.
And so what, in your opinion, is likely to happen come January 27th, the deadline set by the United Nations for the report back from Hans Blix?
Unlike some other people, I don't regard that as the next potential trigger date signifying whether or not President Bush signs the ultimate authorization order for the commencement of a ground campaign. You know, it's just another progress report. The president could have already signed such an order. He might decide to wait a couple of weeks after that. It's just another little data point, and it doesn't have any value beyond signifying that that's the date that a report is due. I think other factors probably weigh more, have greater weight than that. Simply reports from commanders in the field regarding regarding the logistical arrangement necessary. Are they marrying up the troops with the pre-positioned equipment? Are new stores of ammunition flowing into the field on time? There's a certain amount of training up time for newly arriving units in the theater to acclimate themselves to the weather conditions, to familiarize themselves with the geography of the theater, to establish their comm frequencies, to establish table of organization equipment. I frankly think all those things are much more significant than report coming from Hans Blix.
I'm reading a report today in the Washington Post that basically says on Monday it was the heaviest day of bombing in at least a year. What are the chances that with these bombings increasing, that ultimately at some point Iraq is going to fire back and actually hit someone and then provoke a war or provoke an opportunity for the U.S. to say this is now war?
Well, I think the Bush administration has made it very clear over the years that there's not a lot that Iraq says or even does that will make an impact insofar as their decision to go to war or perhaps more relevantly, not to go to war. You know, I mean, their position has always been, for example, with regard to nuclear, biological, and chemical weapons that are at the heart of this issue, that if Iraq says it does not have them, then the United States says, well, we know you're lying, and, you know, that's a provocation and sufficient reason to go to war. If Iraq says it does have them, then the United States says, aha, you see, you've confirmed what we said all along. You can't be trusted. You have these things in violation of Resolution 687, and therefore you should be deposed, and we go to war anyway. So, you know, from a viewpoint of logic, Iraq is sort of stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Any final thoughts on your part, Mr. Eisenberg?
I simply think that people should pay, you know, less attention to what's coming out of the Security Council and the level of the international diplomacy, and pay more attention simply to the deployment of movements. Military professionals sort of have an old saying, which is that amateurs talk about strategy, professionals talk about logistics. To a degree, I think that's a very wise saying, and I think perhaps in his heart of hearts, President Bush hasn't made a definitive decision one way or the other. But a lot of machinery has been set in motion, and about the only factors at this point which might possibly dissuade them about giving the ultimate order to have a ground war is anxiety about what could potentially happen in other parts of the world, notably North Korea. That and the logistics, I think, are the determining factors about what happens next with regard to Iraq.
David Eisenberg of the British American Security Information Council. Monday, of course, is the day recognized as the national holiday celebrating the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr. Since today is his actual birthday, however, in honor of his life and work, Peace Watch is presenting one of his final speeches from the Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, Georgia, on February 3, 1968, exactly 2 months before his assassination. The drum major, Instinct.
This morning I would like to use as a subject from which to preach the drum major instinct. The drum major instinct. And our text for the morning is taken from a very familiar passage in the 10th chapter as recorded by St. Mark, beginning with the 35th verse of that chapter. We read these words: "And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldest do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? And they said unto him, Grant unto us that we may sit, one on thy right hand and the other on thy left hand, in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, Ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, We can. And Jesus said unto them, Ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized, withal shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared. And then Jesus goes on toward the end of that passage to say, But so shall it not be among you, but whosoever will be great among you shall be your servant, and whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. The setting is clear. James and John are making a specific request of the Master. They had dreamed, as most of the Hebrews dreamed, of a coming king of Israel who would set Jerusalem free and establish his kingdom on Mount Zion and in righteousness rule the world. And they thought of Jesus as this kind of king, and they were thinking of that day when Jesus would reign supreme as this new king of Israel. And they were saying, now, when you establish your kingdom, let one of us sit on the right hand and the other on the left hand of your throne. Now, very quickly, we would automatically condemn James and John, and we would say they were selfish. Why would they make such a selfish request? But before we condemn them too quickly, let us look calmly and honestly at ourselves, and we will discover that we too have those same basic desires for recognition, for importance, that same desire for attention, that same desire to be first. Of course, the other disciples got mad with James and John, and you could understand why, but we must understand that we have some of the same James and John qualities. And that is deep down within all of us, an instinct. It's a kind of drum major instinct, a desire to be out front, a desire to lead the parade, a desire to be first. And it is something that runs the whole gamut of life. And so before we condemn them, let us see that we all have the drum major instinct. We all want to be important, to surpass others, to achieve distinction, to lead the parade. Alfred Adler, the great psychoanalyst, contends that this is the dominant impulse. Sigmund Freud used to contend that sex was the dominant impulse, and Adler came with a new argument saying that this quest for recognition, this desire for attention, this desire for distinction is the basic impulse, the basic drive of human life, this drum major instinct. And you know, we begin early to ask life to put us first. Our first cry as a baby was a bid for attention. And all through childhood, the drum major impulse or instinct is a major obsession. Children ask life to grant them first place. They are a little bundle of ego. They have innately the drum major instinct. Now, in adult life, we still have it, and we really never get by it. We like to do something good, and, you know, we like to be praised for it. Now, if you don't believe that, you just go on living life, and you will discover very soon that you like to be praised. Everybody likes it, as a matter of fact. And somehow this warm glow we feel when we are praised or when our name is in print is something of the vitamin A to our ego. Nobody is unhappy when they are praised, even if they know they don't deserve it and even if they don't believe it. The only unhappy people about praise is when that praise is going too much towards somebody else. But everybody likes to be praised because of this real drum major instinct. Do you know that a lot of the race problem grows out of the drum major instinct? A need that some people have to feel superior. A need that some people have to feel that they are first and to feel that their white skin ordained them to be first. And they have said over and over again, in ways that we see with our own eyes. In fact, not too long ago, a man down in Mississippi said that God was a charter member of the White Citizens Council. And so, God being the charter member means that everybody who's in that has a kind of divinity, a kind of superiority. And think of what has happened in history as a result of this perverted use of the drum major instinct. It's led to the most tragic prejudice, the most tragic expressions of man's inhumanity to man. And not only does this thing go into the racial struggle, it goes into the struggle between nations. And I would submit to you this morning that what is wrong in the world today is that the nations of the world are engaged in a bitter, colossal contest for supremacy. And if something doesn't happen to stop this trend, I'm sorely afraid that we won't be here to talk about Jesus Christ and about God and about brotherhood too many more years. If somebody doesn't bring an end to this suicidal thrust that we see in the world today, none of us are going to be around, because somebody's going to make the mistake through our senseless blunderings of dropping a nuclear bomb somewhere, and then another one is going to drop. And don't let anybody fool you. This can happen within a matter of seconds. Amen. They have 20 megaton bombs in Russia right now that can destroy a city as big as New York in 3 seconds with everybody wiped away in every building. And we can do the same thing to Russia and China. But this is why we are drifting, and we are drifting there. Because nations are caught up with the drum major instinct. I must be first. I must be supreme. Our nation must rule the world. And I am sad to say that the nation in which we live is the supreme culprit. And I'm going to continue to say it to America, because I love this country too much to see the drift that it has taken. God didn't call America to do what she's doing in the world now.
Preach it. God didn't call America to engage in a senseless, unjust war as the war in Vietnam. And we are criminals in that war. We've committed more war crimes almost than any nation in the world. And I'm going to continue to say it. And we won't stop it because of our pride and our arrogance as a nation. But God has a way of even putting nations in their place. Amen. The God that I worship has a way of saying, don't play with me. He has a way of saying, as the God of the Old Testament used to say, to the Hebrews, don't play with me, Israel. Don't play with me, Babylon. Be still and know that I'm God. If you don't stop your reckless course, I'll rise up and break the backbone of your power. Yes. And that can happen to America. Yes. Every now and then I go back and read Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. And when I come and look at America, I say to myself, the parallels are frightening. And we have perverted the drum major instinct. But let me rush on to my conclusion, because I want you to see what Jesus was really saying. What was the answer that Jesus gave these men? It's very interesting. One would have thought that Jesus would have condemned them. One would have thought that Jesus would have said, you are out of your place. You are selfish. Why would you raise such a question? But that isn't what Jesus did. He did something altogether different. He said in substance, oh, I see. You want to be first? You want to be great? You want to be important? You want to be significant? Well, you ought to be. If you're going to be my disciple, you must be. But he reordered priorities. And he said, yes, don't give up this instinct. It's a good instinct if you use it right. Yes. It's a good instinct if you don't distort it and pervert it. Don't give it up. Keep feeling the need for being important. Keep feeling the need for being first. But I want you to be first in love. I want you to be first in moral excellence. I want you to be first in generosity. That is what I want you to do. And he transformed the situation by giving a new definition of greatness. And you know how he said it? He said, now, brethren, I can't give you greatness. And really, I can't make you first. This is what Jesus said to James and John. You must earn it. True greatness comes not by favoritism, but by fitness. And the right hand and the left are not mine to give. They belong to those who are prepared. And so Jesus gave us a new norm of greatness. If you want to be important, wonderful. If you want to be recognized, wonderful. If you want to be great, wonderful. But recognize that he who is greatest among you shall be your servant. That's a new definition of greatness. And this morning, the thing that I like about it, by giving that definition of greatness, it means that everybody can be great. Everybody. Because everybody can serve. Every now and then, I guess we all think realistically,
yes,
about that day when we will be victimized with what is life's final common denominator. That's something that we call death. We all think about it, and every now and then I think about
my own death, and I think about my own funeral, and I don't think of it in a morbid sense. Every now and then I ask myself, what is it that I would want said? And I leave the word to you this morning. If any of you are around when I have to meet my day, I don't want a long funeral. And if you get somebody to deliver the eulogy, tell them not to talk too long. And every now and then I wonder what I want them to say. Tell them not to mention that I have a Nobel Peace Prize. That isn't important. Tell them not to mention that I have 300 or 400 other awards. That's not important. Tell them not to mention where I went to school. I'd like somebody to mention that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to give his life serving others. I'd like for somebody to say that day that Martin Luther King Jr. tried to love somebody. I want you to say that day that I tried to be right on the war question. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try to feed the hungry. I want you to be able to say that day that I did try in my life to clothe those who were naked. I want you to say on that day that I did try in my life to visit those who were in prison. I want you to say that I tried to love and serve humanity. Yes, if you want to say that I was a drum major, say that I was a drum major for justice. Say that I was a drum major for peace. I was a drum major for righteousness. And all of the other shallow things will not matter. I won't have any money to leave behind. I won't have the fine and luxurious things of life to leave behind. But I just want to leave a committed life behind. And that's all I want to say. If I can help somebody as I pass along, if I can cheer somebody with a word of song, if I can show somebody he's traveling wrong, then my living will not be in vain. If I can do my duty as a Christian ought, if I can bring salvation to a world once wrought, if I can spread the message as the Master taught, then my living will not be in vain. Yes, Jesus, I want to be on your right or your left side. Not for any selfish reason. I want to be on your right or your left side, not in terms of some political kingdom or ambition, but I just want to be there in love and in justice and in truth.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment. Thank you.